November 5, 2022, it's Watch for Pedro Show.
Pedro Show.
happy Saturday. Start off with Crepuscula with Nelly. Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane. Live at the Five Spot, 1957, year I was born. Then we had William Parker with Airlift. Voices Fall from the Sky. I guess it was a collab. Oh, I should tell you, people, because the Estonian software engineers with their Skype invention, I got with me, Mr. William Parker. Welcome to Watt Pedro Show, William.
Oh, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Big honor. And thanks to Stevie and Steven for making this happen. Can you bring your earliest musical recollection, please?
Well, my earliest introduction to music was when I was about 7 years old. My father had two heroes, and one of them was Duke Ellington, and the other one was the Apache chief, Geronimo. And he would come home from work and play the 1957 recording of Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue of Duke Ellington live in Newport. And he did that like every night, you know. And also on the weekends, there were music of Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, Johnny Hodges. And those were strong images and sounds that this I remember and kind of stuck with me my whole teenage years until I decided to begin to play music. But actually, what happened was my father just came home one day, and he gave me a trumpet, and he gave my brother a alto saxophone. And I realized that later on, you know, we went for lessons, and I realized later on that was my father's dream for us to play in the Ellington Orchestra.
Whoa. Wasn't there a time when Duke Ellington experimented with two bass players?
He might have. He had some great, great bass players. One of my latter influences of his music was when he did the Far East Suites and Soul Call. He had a bass player called John Lamb.
Yeah.
Who was very, very, very great bass player and interesting bass player. And, you know, of course, before that and way back, he had, you know, Jimmy Blanton.
Jimmy Blanton, of course.
Yeah. And even Mingus played with him for a very short time. So he's always had very, very good musicians. And the band was based off of his music, but also the personalities of the musicians
right.
that wrote for.
Which is a beautiful thing. I asked you that because I've been reading these biographies on John Coltrane, where he got the two bass idea was from Duke Ellington, some of these books say. Like Seals, Simpkins, okay. Mr. Simpkins' book, and Bill Cole's book, and so that's why I asked you. In this pad, before your pop brought the trumpet and the alto, was there instruments, or were those the first instruments brought into the pad?
Well, we used to, one of our favorite games when we were growing up was jam session, and we used to have these Mattel Fanner 50 six-shooter guns, and we would turn them around and pretend like they were trumpets. And so we would play jam, you know, like all the other kids, you know, you play tag or shoot 'em up. We yeah. played jam session, and we'd create these characters who were playing, like, solos that lasted for weeks. And, yeah, so it was very, very, very interesting period.
What was
and I didn't realize that was a hip thing to do, you know, until later on.
Yeah, yeah. What was the first record you bought with your own money?
I guess, you know, on Saturday was record buying day, and I would buy my father a record and then buy one for us. I guess the first ones were still like Ben Webster and stuff that kind of, you know, reflected off of my father. But then we saw the Atlantic Records, Ornette Coleman.
Yeah.
And they were switched from Stereo Records to Monaro, and they were selling very cheap, so they had these very interesting covers, like This Is My Music,
yeah.
or Free Jazz. So we didn't know what it sounded like, but we bought it because of the covers. and we liked it. And then when you read the liner notes,
sure.
it hit other musicians, they said, they keep talking about Coltrane. They keep talking about Albert Eiler. They keep talking about Archie Shepp. So we had to find out, so what do these guys sound like?
Yeah.
So, and then one thing just led to another. They talk about a writer, and then eventually you gravitate to like a Mary Baraka's black music, which was like the primer for learning about the music of the 60s.
Right.
And he laid it out with the, you know, the players, you know, Pharoah Sanders, Archie Shepp, John Shakai. And then you realize these guys were on Coltrane's Ascension.
Right.
And Dolphy and
Freddie
Hubbard, Wilbur Ware. And that was the music school. That was how you learned about, you know, your music and the culture extensions of the freedom movement and civil rights movement that were going on, you know, later on in the 60s. So it was a great sort of kinetic passing of energy and information.
Yeah. What was the first gig you saw?
Well, you know, the first gig I saw was a bass player named Peck Morrison, I believe. And he played up in the Bronx at the library up there. And I was trying to put things together, you know, because you hear this music and you say, well, what does that sound like?
Yeah.
What does it look like? So then I saw him. Then later on, I saw a bass player, Victor Gaskin.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess the first bass player I met was Charlie Hayden.
Whoa.
And I met him at 125th Street at the County Cullen Library. He was doing a concert with the vibe player Carl Berger and Horace Arnold and alto player Carlos Ward.
What about school? Were you in the choir, the marching band, or shit like that?
No, I wasn't. Not in any. You know, in junior high school, I was in the band because I switched from trumpet to trombone, then cello, and that's how I got interested in the bass because I was interested in the cello, but what I really wanted to play was the bass. And when I got to high school, I began to work on my aesthetics of living and my aesthetics of music and art. And I was got into film, you know, watching the films of Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut and filmmaker Stan Brakhage, Kenneth Anger, Maya Deren, and I began to expand my scope of things. I was writing poetry and writing plays, little one-act plays, and so I was, you know, stepping out in that area as arts. And then it wasn't until I really, really listened to John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, and he started talking about, you know, I want to be a force for good. I want to play music that will uplift people. And I figured out why music existed. You know, and it didn't exist for people to dance to. It didn't exist for people to, the whole thing was to enlighten and uplift people. So I said, I want to participate in that. That's the reason I want to play music. So then I said, I'll see if I can make a contribution.
Yeah. I want to play Eternal is the Voice of Love. Bit of noise. Where are you at, William? You in Brooklyn?
I'm in the Lower East Side. Are you hearing some music outside?
No, I'm hearing some rattling. Some.
Oh, that, I'm just opening up some lunch here.
Okay.
But it's over. Okay.
It's real. No. Let's tell the people we just heard. That chunk of music started off with Eternal is the Voice of Love, Part 2, Color Against Autumn Sky. William Parker, In Order to Survive. The Shape of Iriamu to Come. Iriamu, this is Will Hamilton's the last part of his song cycle. Many birthdays after that brand new, with the cover of You're Dead. Disciplina Kishma from early 80s, I think 1981, in fact. It's called, still called Yugoslavia then. Svita Mise, the Go Team featured Star Feminine Band, Look Away, Look Away, that's brand new from them. Beat Goes On, from the Screamers, Matt Gardens Live, 1978. Noem Bucci, brand new, Screaming at Brutism. Tragic Assembly, with Dedicated Shoegaze, that's filling North Carolina. Samuel Lockward, East of Ellen Macon, out of Iowa. And then an excerpt from William Parker's In Case of Accident. So, was your first bass a stand-up?
Yes. I had a bass. There was a store in the Bronx called Bronin's Music Store. And they had a bass in their Juzak base for selling for $100.
Whoa.
And this was like around 1968 or something like that.
Ah, so it'd be like $1,000.
Oh, it'd be more than that now.
Yeah.
It'd be up there, but I still have that base. And so it was kind of days you put down a dollar.
Yeah.
And then you put down another dollar. And so finally, I came in to buy that base to pick it up, and I was a dollar short.
Oh, shit.
And the guy says to me, please, just take it. Just take it. So I took the base.
Yeah.
And I was walking to Webster Avenue to get the bus back home, and a guy ran up to me and he said, "Man, you a bass player?" And I said, "Who are you talking to?" He said, "I said, you, man, you got a bass. You're a bass player." I said, "Yeah, I'm a bass player." I said, "Man, why don't you come to the jam session on Sunday?" This was like Monday, so I said, "Okay." So I got the address, and then I remember a few weeks before that, I saw Charlie Hayden, and he told me, well, he learned how to play the bass by listening to records and playing along with music.
Yeah.
So I said, I come to the jam session. So I came to the jam session. I practiced all week. And Sunday I got up to the jam session, and they were so happy. You know, the bass player, they never had a bass player. So I got there, and they said, you know, straight, no chase, and F. I said, yeah, that's beautiful. And I didn't know what an F or a B flat or a C or a D was.
Did you know the tune? Did you know the tune?
No, I didn't know the tune.
Oh, you know, because you could know the tune without knowing the chords. So I was just curious.
No, I didn't know the tune. But you know, so then we played, and I picked it up right away. And then they said, man, you got a good feel on that bass, man. So they started giving me solos. And I played all of these tunes all by ear. And then I noticed that my fingers were big red bubbles that had blood underneath my two fingers. And I said, I got to get out of this. So I said, well, hey, cats, man, you know, they're supposed to call each other cats. And so I didn't know what they were talking about at first. I thought they had cats in the apartment, but that was jazz musician talk. So I said, man, I got another thing to go. So I packed up, and then that next week I went to the Jazzmobile Music School.
Wow.
And cause I said, I gotta get to where I'm doing. So I went down there, and Paul West, who was the bassist with Dizzy Gillespie, mm-hmm. running the ensemble, and I met Kenny Durham. I met Curtis Fuller, Roland Hanna was there, Freddie Waits, Albert Tootie Heath, Lee Morgan was there, Curtis, the other, Benny Powell was there, and then the bass teacher was Richard Davids.
Whoa.
So I went there for a couple of weeks, you know, and they learned something about the bass.
Yeah.
Although in my heart, you know, every time I would go over to Joe Newman and said, man, you know, what about Albert Isle and Archie Shepp? They said, oh, no, we don't do that here. No, we don't do that here, Parker. We don't do that. So I said, if you want that, you got to go downtown. So I, you know, slowly migrated from there to taking lessons with Jimmy Garrison.
Whoa.
And he lived on Western Avenue, so he charged $18 for a lesson. And so I did that, and it was very fruitful. Hanging out with him, I met Beaver Harris. I met a bunch of musicians, the lawyer, William Kunstler.
Wow.
And so
that was John Coltrane's manager.
Well, yeah, you know, he was a lawyer for a lot of the Black Panthers and
Lovett, Mr. Lovett, that's who I'm thinking of, because he was Miles Davis's man. Yeah, yeah, I remember Mr. Kunstler with the Panthers and stuff. I was born in 57, so I'm a little bit younger, but I remember those days as a boy. Do you think playing the bone helped you inform some stuff on the base?
Not really. I think just beginning to study the concept of making sound and beginning to know the aesthetics of the music really helped me. Because I kind of knew what I wanted to do before I picked, you know, I took a lesson. Yeah. I wanted to play free jazz. I wanted to play the fire music. I wanted to play the cosmic music.
Right. And so you didn't really, what about people like Paul Chambers and Ray Brown and stuff?
Well, in the bass, you know, workshop, Art Davis was there 1 week.
Incredible. And, Dr. Art Davis.
And Milton came by, and, you know, so took some stuff with them. You know something?
What
I found out was they said, you know, well, everybody was trying to transcribe Paul Chambers.
Okay.
And so I looked at it and heard it, and I said, there's no way in a million years I'm gonna sound like Paul Chambers.
Yeah.
And then later on I found out that that was one of the best things I could have done, is not try to sound like Paul Chambers, because I realized that Paul Chambers is Paul Chambers, and I was William Parker, and I had to find out where I was on the instrument and what I heard, how I heard music. And that's when that came to come to the concept of musical DNA, that everybody had their own musical DNA and they had their own path, their own way of doing things. And I had to find my way.
That's an excellent point. Excellent. I wish more people would take that to heart. Because, yeah, you have giants and heroes, but the idea is not to copy.
I mean, you can copy them, but then after a while, you got to cut them loose.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes real good sense. And you were carrying that bass, or did you have a case, like some kind of cover?
Yeah, I had a cover. Okay. It came with a cover, a soft cover, and I would just put, you know, take a strap, take a rope, put it on my back, and I'm off and running.
Oh, wow, because I've seen pictures of Jimmy Garrison, like, with a wheel on the peg.
Yeah, I was trying to find a place to get a wheel, but I could never find a place to get a wheel, so I ended up making my own wheel.
Okay.
And so it was a William Parker wheel,
yeah.
And I used that for a while. When that broke, I would fix it. And later on, I found out that they did have it. When I discovered something called the bass shop, and I didn't have to do my own bass repairs. It was actually someone called a luthier that could repair the bass. They also sold a bass wheel called the Ray Brown bass wheel.
I got to see him play a few times. He's an incredible bass man. Incredible bass. Look, we're at the end of the first hour, November 5, 2022, edition Watt Peters, with special guest William Parker. Hold tight for hour two. November 5, 2022 is the second hour of the Watt from Pedro Show.
You have to think and wake up. Wake up. You got to change the inside of your soul. You got to get rid of the mold. You have to change your soul. And you'll never grow old. You'll never grow old. Look out! Look out! Listen to my words. They must be heard. Revolution from the inside out. Think. Wink. But don't blink. Be strong and sing your song. How intellectual is a bullet? Come out! Come out! Wherever you are, unite! Become the mountain and dance. Paint the sunlight and make it bright. Get on board. Get on board. Freedom train. Freedom train. Free yourself from yourself. Free yourself from yourself. Do the tone. world of the ancient future that will repeat itself. That will repeat itself. If 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 that will repeat itself.
Pedro show start off the second hour, Samba, William Parker featuring Lena Concourse. After that, we had Lisa Cameron, Damon Smith, Alex Cunningham doing Unforeseen Ciphers of the World. And then Song for Jesus in 3/4 time, William Parker Quartet. Yeah, you know what trips me out about reading these bios on John Coltrane? The heaviness, how 3/4 was like a radical move, because everything, a lot of that bop was just straight 4. And, yeah, it shook up a lot of feathers. It seems a lot of things did, man. The critics in those days, oh, man, I guess this Downbeat magazine kind of ruled the scene, and terrible stuff they would write about John Coltrane. Back to your... besides jamming with those guys, and you're going to this, you're taking lessons from Jimmy Garrison and such, do you join a unit?
Well, you know, after Jimmy Garrison, some wonderful things happened. You know, I just began playing with people. I played at a place called The Firehouse, which was 611 East, 304 East 11th Street, owned by a saxophone player named Alan Glover. And I began playing with him. And right around the corner from there, Andrew Hill lived. And in that place, the Firehouse, we rehearsed at, I met Billy Higgins.
Whoa.
And Billy Higgins, we began to play duos. He invited me out to his house in Brooklyn, and the first time I went out there, I met Clifford Jordan and the piano player Chris Anderson, and Wolf O'Ware was also out there. So I met all these musicians, and then different things happened with my relationship with them. I began studying with Wilbur, and I met Rashid Ali, I met Sonny Murray, I met Charles Tyler, I met Earl Cross, I met Frank Lowe. I eventually met Frank Wright. I met Cecil Taylor. I met Don Cherry. In 1975, I played with Don Cherry at the Five Spot and a reincarnation of the Five Spot. And then I used to play at a place called Hilly's on the Bowery, which later became CBGB's. I played there with Rashid Ali.
In the Five Spot, it was like the Lower West Side, right? Like Hudson Street or something.
Well, this one that opened up, the latest version of it was on St. Mark's Place.
Oh, on the east side, okay.
Yeah, the last version of it.
And Wilbur Ware, he played a lot with Thelonious Monk. Did you learn Thelonious Monk stuff from him?
Well, you know, Wilbur, I asked Wilbur about Monk. I said, when you played with Monk, what did you do? What did he tell you to play? And he said that... Monk told him he can play anything you want to play.
You know, there's an interview with John Coltrane and August Blum, and he talks about what an inventive bass player Wilbur Ware was.
Yeah, no, Wilbur was the bomb. And the thing is that you never knew whether Wilbur knew anything about music. And I would ask Wilbur, I said, well, Wilbur, do you know anything about music? And he would say, what's music?
Natural.
And the thing is that, you know, I would go in for my bass lesson. He would play something on the bass. And then he would give me the bass. And then if I played what he played, he'd say, that's wrong. Then he'd play something else, and then he'd pass the bass to me. If I played what he played, he says, that's wrong. Then he would pass the bass to me, play something, he'd play something. Then I'd play something on my own, he said, that's right. Yeah. And he says, when you study here, basically what he's saying, you don't sound like me.
Yeah.
You don't steal my licks, you don't sound like me, you find yourself. And when I played myself, he loved it.
Wow, that's beautiful. I'm going to play this music you gave me here, Silver Sunshine.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro Show, that chunk of music starred with William Parker doing Silver Sunshine. Then we had Eugene Chadbourne with what? Shiver Board with Ann Hill. And then the Morning Mantra from William Parker Orchestra. William, what was your first composition you wrote on the bass?
Well, you know, I like the idea of filmmakers who were directors and screenwriters. And that was every filmmaker I liked, you know, from Ingmar Bergman to François Truffaut, Jean-Luc Godard. They would direct the movie and they would write the screenplay. And one of the first things I did was the composition called Después de la Guerra, which means after the war. And that's recorded for Voices Fall from the Sky. And it's the point it's in Spanish, you know, after the war, there's still a war. The land is dying, but there's still hope. That's the sentiment there. And I never had a piano, so I either would write all my music off of the bass and or I would, you know, sing it and figure it out, because I literally, you know, it was a long time down the line that I got a piano. And when I got a piano, by then I was anti, well, why does everything have to be based off of the piano? You know, we don't live in Europe. We live in America, and we're African descent. So I'm saying, well, why can't things be based off of the drum or off of the cora or off of a bamboo flute? So I began to look for different sort of fundamentals or foundations for how the music was constructed, because I feel in one way, you know, because of imperialism, you have pianos all over the world.
Right. One button, you know, for each note.
So, you know, like, why don't you have, you know, Indian, why don't you have tablas all over the world? You know, why are they just in India? You know, because, again, you know, it's like, it's told, okay, slaves, you don't have any culture. You got to learn how to make tea for the Queen of England. So, you know, you occupy a country and then you say, okay, the Queen in England is now your queen, and this is the tea ceremony. Meanwhile, you're forgetting, saying that all the culture, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of culture and repertoire that's been developed through music and art and dance in your country is valueless, because I'm English or Dutch or Portuguese, or I'm, even the people who supposedly discovered America or found America were English, Dutch, Portuguese, and the indigenous culture was neglected. You know, when you read and study about it, you find out that Yotaka Iyotaka Sitiville was a great composer. When I mention composers of American composers, I always mention Geronimo, Goyal, and I always mention Sitting Bull, because they composed chants, bird songs, nature songs, and then not ever included. When I talk about minimalist composers, you know, I always mention James Brown, because James Brown would just start a song with a You can't get no more minimal than that.
No, very.
You know, one sound with an utterance, and then it would just take off. And then we're off. So I consider him a minimalist composer. So it's, you know, I think these things, the education has to be widened a little bit with about who's who. And we have to sort of begin to control our own scenario and narrative about music and art.
Because they're going to get it wrong. And there's a reason why they're giving it to everybody wrong. I'm glad you brought up that about the piano, because reading Charles Mingus' Beneath the Underdog, he said he only composed on piano. He wouldn't compose on bass.
Well, because, you know, a lot of musicians, again, however brilliant they are, they know what they know and what they've been told. You know, what you call something called post-traumatic slave syndrome, where black Americans are in the country, but they think, you know, the phrase like, you know, they're trying to straighten their hair for years and years because they're told that they're ugly. They're told that their music is not music. But if you go to the conservatory and learn that music, then you're really a musician. But if you just like make your own drum and tune it and play it, so that's not music. That's primitive music. That's folk music. But the other music is classical music. So it's really sort of a a wrong idea, is what I feel. A very, very wrong idea.
I agree with you 100%. You know, we're at the end of the second hour, November 5, 2022, edition of Why Pedro Show, special guest William Parker. Hold tight for hour three. November 5, 2022, it's the third hour. Why Pedro Show. Here we go.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
The sound. The sound. The sound.
Watt for Pedro show. We start off the third hour with Sun Salt, William Parker, featuring Ellen Christie. Then Hot Pursuit of Happiness with the sound, William Parker, Tabasco. You like Tabasco? Or is it the...
I'm learning.
Okay. Because it's a state, too, in Mexico, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no burn, no learn, right? And tell me about Ellen Christie. You know, and who was this other lady, too, Lena Conquest?
Well, Ellen Christie was one of the first people I met in the early 70s. When she first came to New York, she was a singer, and she lived over at 501 Canal Street, building founded by, at that time, Gene Ashton, also known as Cooper Moore now, and David S. Ware lived over there, Alan Brofman, drummer Tom Bruno, and she studied with Gene Lee, her as well as another singer, Lisa Sokoloff. And she's been on the scene with the New York City Artist Collective and doing her own work for all of these years. It's now 2022, and we just came up with a collaboration that's going to probably be released in 2023. And it's just her doing arranging off of my music and electronics and spoken word. I'm doing all spoken word on it. And that'll be out next year.
And Lena Conquest?
And Lena, I met Lena, I guess, in the 90s through an artist, at an artist house, Alan Carilli. And she just told me, you know, she was a singer. And I needed a singer for a project, and so I called. And this is something I do all my life. I hadn't heard her sing, but I said, okay, I gave her a call, and we did this the concert, and then she fit right in with the concept I was dealing with called Raining on the Moon, which was an extension of the quartet with the vocalist. And there were a lot of vocal music. Like I said, I wrote words, and there was a lot of vocal music. And so, you know, we always needed more than one singer to do the interpretation because of a huge variety of material and ideas. So, and she she did the Curtis Mayfield project with us called The Inside Songs of Curtis Mayfield. And many, many, many trips to Europe and doing workshops here in America. And this is a great asset to the music.
Yeah. Let me ask you about Testimony, because that's the first thing I saw you do live. And I got the cassette, I remember, at the end of the gig. A Testimony.
That's a solo bass, right?
Right, exactly.
Well, it's, you know, the idea of playing solo has been a mainstay in Europe. They have solo bass, solo tuba, solo flute, whatever instrument you have. People would come, sit down, listen. You could hear a pin drop, and they'd listen to someone, you know, play their instrument solo.
Yeah.
And so I had taken bass solos all my life and just began to sort of move over from away from the band to investigate the material and stratas and textures of playing solo bass. I was beginning to get a concept of sound, and I began to sort of mark down what I thought of the solo bass and what I thought of the bass, that I was looking at the bass like a drum, and my G string was a ride cymbal, my D string was a snare drum, My A string was a low tom-tom, and my E string was a gong. And then that's playing pizzicato. Then playing arco, I looked at each string as a band of light. And when you put a prism, you put light through a prism, you see these colors. Yeah. And those harmonics. And in the harmonics were the healing aspects of sound. And so that's what I want to investigate. So we did, you know, this piece, Cathedral of Light.
Yeah.
Which again is just all harmonics and all, like, you know, you're closing your eyes and you're waking up and you see all of this light, and which also began to move towards what one calls a tone world. And that was sort of the basis for the mythology of the music that I was being associated with, because they said, well, you know, you get labeled as free jazz, but to me, free jazz is basically you are free to do what you want to do within a piece of music. And I learned that when I was playing with Cecil Taylor. When I played with Cecil Taylor, yeah, I was free to play the blues, to play a samba, to play a bossa nova, yeah, to play 6/8, 7/8. All of this stuff I was free to do in any piece of music that we did. And but I don't know if people heard it or not, but that's really not my, you know, concern so much. But, you know, it was the idea that you're free to do what you want with your life, and you're free to do what you want in your music. So that was, to me, free jazz. And people think it's like playing free with no rules. You know, there are rules to everything. There's nothing in life that doesn't have rules or consequences, or that doesn't have a map or a structure. Everything has structure. There's nothing in the world that has no structure.
Right, right. Yeah, we use these words that are kind of not telling the truth sometimes. Look, I want to play another song that you sent me with Ellen Christie. Something live.
To see the sunrise. If you kill me now, you have killed yourself. We truly are one. Let us live in peace. Let me live to see tomorrow. I am your brother. Please don't cut my throat. I am your sister. Please don't cut my throat. Let me live to see the sunrise. I saw a black angel,
I saw a black angel standing by.
writing poems on the sky. Writing poems on the sky. Writing poems on the sky.
Watt from Pedro Show. Last music for this edition. Start off with This Is My Country. Live. William Parker featuring Ellen Christie and the New Life Tabernacle Generation. Praise Choir, Brooklyn. Then we had a bass player out of Chicago, Nick Macri, and Mono Nalawara. How to Be in the Body. Rubber O Cement with Yawn Count, Takeoff. And finally, Tootsie Orphans. William Parker. I guess this is from the Raining on the Moon ensemble.
Yes.
Where can people find you on the internet? Do you have a website?
Well, I think it's just williamparkermusic.net.
Okay.
.com. You just put William Parker. It'll come right up.
Okay.
So music. It'll come right up.
Yeah, that's a great resource. And what are your plans? Your next plans? What are your future plans here?
Well, I'm playing this evening in New York at 107 Suffolk Street, Clemente's Soto Valles Cultural Center. And we're doing a group called Southern Satellites,
yeah,
which is a mixture of Dominican and Cuban and sort of a Latin flavor and African rhythms,
yeah,
blended with melodies and excursions into creative, free-flowing music, ballads, and I'm doing that tonight at 8 o'clock, part of Arts for Art event. And then November 20th, I'll be in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
Playing with Daniel Carter and the drummer Mike Reed.
You know what drummer man ended up in Madison was? Clyde Stubblefield.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Great drummer. Did you ever see Bobby Boykin with the Sun Ra?
Ronnie Boykins?
Yeah.
Oh, I used to hang out with Ronnie Boykins all the time.
Because he wrote songs for Sun Ra, right?
I think he did.
I covered one of his songs, Tiny Pyramids. And, you know, I really think that's the future of a lot of bass is as composers. Not trying to be fake guitarists, you know, 10, 12 strings and stuff. But as a composition instrument, I just think there's a lot of future.
Well, I find that, you know, all bass players are just being great bass players is that bass players can, you know, really guide and help navigate the music and push the music, know when to play soft, know when to play louder, know when to play fast, know when to play soft, but they also have a very good sense of composition.
Uh-huh.
Very good sense of composition and how to put music together because they work with a lot of different people doing different kinds of music.
Absolutely. And, you have to fit it in there, right? Because, like, a lot of people are composing on the piano and the guitar and, you know,
the music, the sound comes in your head.
Yeah.
And you sort of have to, you know, remember it, write it down to convey it to other people. And you can do that many different ways. Like Charles Mingus would sing his music.
Right.
And because he wasn't all that deep on you know, notating. It was later on he had people orchestrate and notate for him.
Right.
But he would sing the music, and you'd get it, you know. So how you convey the music or share the music with musicians, there are lots of ways of doing that. It's just whatever is your preference.
Okay, that makes good sense. Just something about, I think the bass is still kind of mysterious, and that's a positive thing.
Right.
People feel it even more than they hear it. But I love your tone. When I saw that gig, you doing the testimony, God, it was sweaty. It was a July or August day. Man, it was sweaty, but I just can't ever. The tone, there's nothing like a good stand-up bass sound. It's such an honor to have you aboard. Anytime you want to come on the show, William, you got new music or anything, you're invited, okay?
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Keep on keeping on, please. People, it's been the November 5, 2022 edition of What Peter Show. Keep your powder dry.